Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hello, welcome to the group chat. Richard and Gavin in this week. Gavin, how are you doing?
Not too bad, Richard. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad, not too bad. We're going to jump straight into it. Yes. Obviously, Zara is away this week. But one thing I've actually noticed over the last number of weeks and months, particularly in my own inbox, is people asking how Ibrahim Alaga and his family have been doing since coming back from Gaza. Obviously, we've had a focus on Gaza over the last number of months since then because it showed no signs of abating, but there has been an interest in how those who've come back from Gaza have fared,
of course,
younger kids.
And of course, while they were away, you were receiving voice notes from Ibrahim talking about the situation before they were able to get out, and we were able to share them on the podcast. And there were a lot of people then very invested in him getting home and how they're getting on since.
Yeah. So one thing we wanted to do today was to give Sammy, who is 8 years old, from Blanchardstown, of course, he wanted to have an opportunity to explain to people in Ireland, to kids of his own age, what life is like for kids in Gaza. So we spoke to Ibrahim and Sammy earlier on, and here's how we got on. Guys, delighted to have you back.
Thank you very much.
Great to have you.
Thanks. Thanks, Adon.
Ibrahim, how has life been since you've gotten back to Ireland?
Well, for me and my family here, we're doing great, I think. We're back to normal life. But it's very stressful when it comes to our family and our friends and people in Gaza.
Yeah.
You know what's going on. A huge shortage of food and water, and people just living in the streets and tents, and the pictures we see are making us really stressful, you know.
The last time that you were on the podcast in audio note form, because you were sending audio notes to Richard, and then passed them on, you and was it 80 or 90 other people from your extended family all living in one house? Where are they now? Where are they all?
Oh, they're scattered everywhere. So some of them went to Rafah. Some of them went close to the coast. It's an area called Mawasi. So these are the areas that were supposed to be the safe areas. Unfortunately, that's not the case. Many people have lost their lives over there. It's everywhere around the areas.
Sammy, what's it like being back in Ireland?
Better than staying in Gaza.
Yeah.
If we are there, we will be so hungry and thirsty, and it's very cold. And it's very cold over there, so they have no clothes.
Yeah, because I remember people might have seen you were at the weekend. You were flying your kite, and you said a few words, which people saw. What could you just tell people? Because I mean, I think it was very, very powerful in getting people to know what's life like for kids of your age in Gaza. That must be. That was very, very impressive what you did. What is life like for kids like your cousins in Gaza?
Like, they told me they're hungry and tired. And they told me last time they called me, they told me that a rocket came right beside him and all the sand came on their hair.
Yeah. Ibrahim, that must be incredibly difficult because people will have seen since, you know, before Christmas when we were last talking to you, things get worse and worse and worse.
Yeah.
And people get forced further and further into safe zone to safe zone to safe zone, now down to Rafah in a corner, effectively, where more than 1.4 million people are squeezed. Knowing so many people as you do who are in that situation and hearing, even as, you know, your kids are hearing this as well, how difficult and how close, you know, to home this is becoming, that must be hugely worrying for you.
Absolutely. As he just said, there was a story where I think a week ago there was a missile just beside where his cousins were staying, and everyone was just covered in sand and dust and all of that. So you just hear the stories, and now even with Rafah being also they're talking about, you know, going inside of Rafah. Where are people going to go after? There's nowhere else to go, you know. So it's very, very stressful. I have a brother and a sister-in-law still over there. I have aunts and uncles and cousins. They're still over there as well. We're always worried about them. Unfortunately, that's the situation.
Just take that one example of the rocket that fell just beside where Sammy's cousins are. I know that sometimes the information isn't always very clearly offered anyway, but was there any kind of a explanation or a justification, any kind of public reasoning as to why that sort of area might have been targeted?
No, it's very random. that's the case really most of the time, is you will see a missile coming down. Nobody will know why or why they hit this area, or it's getting very random. And it's honestly, people don't know, am I going to stay alive or this is going to be my final day? That's, everyone is talking, everyone is saying that now.
Yeah. Do you miss your cousins over there, Sammy?
Yes.
Yeah. What ages are your cousins?
One eight and one like 4 or 5.
Yeah. And that's the thing, Ibrahim, is that we've seen so much how kids are very much at the front line of this and have been all the way through. When you guys were trapped in Gaza, it was, you know, such a young age of people who are trapped, who have been killed, who have been, you know, wounded in all of these bomb attacks. That is something which it's difficult to comprehend when you're sitting over here in the Western world.
Absolutely. It's a lot different when you're in there living it.
Yeah. I mean, how do you think, I mean, because you've had plenty of time now since you've come back to sort of see how the world is treating this situation, when you see how the Irish government is reacting, when you see how Europe is reacting to it.
Unfortunately, now, if we take it on government level, unfortunately, nothing has happened. No one is able to stop Israel from what it's doing. And it's just it's going on and on and on. There's no limits. Every day it's worse and worse. People are dying now from hunger, right? No one is stopping that. No one is stepping in to help, right? On the people's side, the Palestinian Israeli conflict is gathering more and more attention among people. We saw the protest that I think was last Saturday. It was massive, huge. A lot of people are more aware of what's going on, but unfortunately they can't do anything. It's the governments and nothing is happening, nothing is changing.
Mm. Are you disappointed with how Ireland is handling it?
Well, no.
In terms of the government at least.
Well, I'd say it's the best in the Western world, but I don't think it's still enough yet. I think there's still more that needs to be done.
And what would you like to see them do?
A more clear message of call for a ceasefire, joining South Africa maybe, and I'm not sure Brazil as well in the International Court of Justice. Boycott, more boycott.
Yeah,
I don't know. Expelling the Israeli embassy. Mm.
We were talking on their walk down to the studio, and we were talking about the events of the last couple of days, the US apparently trying to negotiate another level of a humanitarian ceasefire while at the same time vetoing somebody else's motion.
Exactly.
How do you feel when you see stuff like that, where America is on one hand saying that it's trying to be constructive, but at the same time also standing in the way of someone else doing it?
As you just said, it's just that's what they're saying. But in action, what the real action is very opposing. It's they're still... arming Israel, I believe. They're still, you know, they're not putting any pressure at all to stop what's going on. I don't know. They don't do any action, I can say.
Sammy, can you tell us, just because people mightn't remember, what it was like when you were in Gaza? I remember there was a lot of loud noises. You got woken up in the middle of the night. Can you just remember what was scary when you were in Gaza?
I remember like two times before the last time I heard like Israel bombing right beside me. It was very loud, and the other one was by Palestine putting missiles to Israel.
Yeah, and what was that like? I mean, that's very, very close to where you guys were, wasn't it?
Yeah, I thought it's like right where we were. Like the missiles were. Came out from, it was right beside. We even saw the missiles.
Yeah. And your classmates, people, kids your age from where you're living now, I mean, they'll have never seen anything like this. They'll have never been through anything like this. I mean, it must have been really scary for you and your brother and sister.
Yeah, even my brother went to sleep when like I told you, when the Israel missile came, my brother waked up. He was crying.
Yeah. I mean, do you think it's important that kids in Ireland know what it's like for kids their own age who are living in Gaza? Because it's very hard for them to sort of know or to see what that's like, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It must be a bit strange for you, Sammy, when you've come home now and you're back living your normal life. You're living at home, you're going to school in Dublin, and all of your classmates might want to ask you questions about what it was like when you're there. But I suppose so much of it was so scary that you'd rather not think about it too much.
Yeah, some of them even told me how did what happened? What did you do to Israel? So they came and did the war. So I told them that Palestine first in like Saturday, they told me that I tell them that they like every second missiles going to Israel.
It must be hard, Ibrahim, to have to, you know, for your kids to have gone through this. And again, absolutely no fault. They were caught in a situation which is, you know, appalled everyone around the world in terms of what's happening to, again, innocent kids like your own. I mean, it must be really difficult to get your head around.
Yeah, yeah. Well, thank God they're strong, resilient. They are a lot better now. But I remember the days when we first came from Gaza, especially my youngest one. He used to wake up a lot of times in the middle of night. I believe he used to have nightmares or something. He used to, for example, if there was a bang, if something fell on the ground, for example, made a bang noise, It seemed like it reminded him of something, you know, and he used to get really scared. But thank God, all of that phase is gone now. They're back to normal. I can see they're back to normal life now, all three of them.
Because I remember even when we were talking back when you were over there, like that was just such a big thing for you, was the idea of getting your kids to safety, back into school,
yes, yes.
And just that sense of safety.
Because it must
have felt like the furthest thing.
Yeah.
Imaginable for you guys when you're in it.
Absolutely, yeah.
Especially when there was all those times, and I'm sure it's something you're experiencing now on the other side of it, when communication became difficult, when the mobile lines were down.
Yeah.
It must have felt that you may never get out of it, and that's something.
Exactly.
How does it feel to be on the other side of that now for your family members who are there?
It's a lot worse now, believe me. I mean, when I was talking to them, they were telling me that the days when I was there, it was like a paradise to what they're living right now, and it's absolutely hell now, you know. I just can't imagine how bad it is right now. They're telling me they're sleeping in tents. It's very cold. They didn't prepare themselves for the winter months, clothes and blankets and all of that. A lot of time it just rains, and they just find out that the place there is just flooded with water. No food. It's really difficult to get food or water or anything. So, and the amount of people and the diseases and all of that, and nothing to do for children, for example. The parents don't want the children to go far away for them or play outside or something like this. It's hell, really.
Mm. You mentioned food, and that's something which everyone is talking about now, because the word famine is now being used to describe what's happening in Gaza. Because remember when you were there, and it was very difficult at times for food, bread in particular was something that was hard to come by.
Yeah.
I mean, when you see now that it's very difficult to even get any aid in, and there was the story there from CNN today that Israel fired upon an aid convoy carrying food to northern Gaza.
Yes.
I mean, I don't think the people over in this part of the world really understand how little food is actually getting in there.
Absolutely, yeah. I've seen reports that people are saying that they saw some cases where people are dying because of hunger. Mm. And especially in the north part of Gaza, that is the area where food is very, very limited. So I don't know how people are surviving, to be honest with you.
What are your family living off?
Very little. Food, you can get food, but it's because it's very limited, it's extremely expensive. So they were telling me, for example, a packet of flour that used to cost before the war less than a euro is now costing around 15 to 20 euro.
Yeah, God.
Right.
Wow.
So, and it's because everything is extremely limited, right? So, they buy stuff, but they try to, you know, just barely make it. it's a lot more difficult, as I said, in the north. Mm. It's a complete different story over there. But that's the situation.
One of the things that strikes me when you're sitting here talking to Sammy, and Sammy's talking about the conversations that he's had with his own classmates since he's come home, is that one of the greatest tragedies of any conflict like this is that it kind of takes away that level of innocence that any child is going to have. Suddenly you have to explain to them geopolitics, and complex history and tribalism. As a father, seeing your children then dragged into this very tumultuous world, it must be a very difficult thing to try and explain to them.
That's the faith of us people from Gaza. That's what we are faced with, you know. People in Gaza are even facing more problems than this, so... We're just in a situation where we have to do this, you know. We have to. Young children are becoming men, you know.
It's far too early in ages.
Sammy,
do you remember when you first went over to Gaza the last time? You stayed in your dad's apartment in Gaza City. Do you remember you lost some things, or some things were left behind there? You left.
Yeah.
Do you remember what you left behind there?
I left my. I had like. What. A table and stuff. I had a trophy of a football.
It was a World Cup trophy, wasn't it?
Yeah. No, like a different one.
Yeah.
A grey one. And my football, a shirt, the Ronaldo one. I left it there. I left my money there.
Yeah.
I left like everything. I thought the war's gonna finish and we're gonna come back. Yeah. So I thought I'm going to leave my stuff here.
You thought it'd all be safe there, yeah.
I just got him new desk and new furniture for their room. It was only a week and they just lost it.
Yeah.
For people who didn't get to see the kite that you had last weekend, Sammy, just tell us about it and the message that you're trying to share.
I was trying to, say to everyone to stop the war in Gaza. What America's help, like in the when we were in Gaza, I thought Israel's gonna finish the war, but then when it's almost gonna finish the war, America came and helped them.
Mm-hmm. It must be. I mean, you must be very proud of Sammy in many ways. This is something that I remember you told me yourself, Sammy, is that what you want to do when you grow up is be a journalist so you could talk about Gaza and explain Gaza to the world. You must be very proud of him.
He's into politics now.
Yeah. I mean, what is your hope? I mean, it's very hard to have any hope, I suppose, when you're in your position, because it must be very hard to make sense of everything that happens on a daily basis and the situation gets worse and worse. But, I mean, is your hope at some point in the near future to go back and to visit Gaza again?
That's a dream, you know. Unfortunately, when I see the videos and the images from Gaza, I mean, I feel so disappointed. All the nice memories that I had, the years I went to university, our apartment, our memories as a family. It's very difficult. I don't know if Gaza's ever going to be, you know, the lovely city that I have in my mind. I don't know if it's ever going to be that again. Hopefully it will be.
Yeah.
I just hope ceasefire comes in soon, this madness stops as soon as possible. But believe me, even when it stops, there's going to be a huge number of problems. I mean, amount of children that lost their parents, you know, schools, universities, hospitals, all gone. There's no houses. It's going to be a very difficult situation, even if things stop tomorrow.
Yeah. And Sammy, if the war did end, would you like to go back and visit your cousins and friends?
When they rebuild, they'll go back.
Yeah. Is that something you'd be looking forward to do?
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, Sammy, you're very brave, and thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for skipping your football as well. You were supposed to have football today, but you were very good to come in and talk to us. So thanks for coming in.
Sammy Ibrahim, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, guys.
So massive thank you to Sammy and to Ibrahim for coming in, and we'll see how they get on, I suppose, in the future too.
Next time Sammy's back, he's going to be hosting.
Guest host in the future when any of us is out is going to be Sammy Alaga. So much to look forward to.
Indeed.
To the improvement of the show when Sammy steps in. But the other story, a more domestic story, Gavin, obviously that has not gone away in any way, and that the broadcaster in question has not been able to put away is the RTE situation. Why is it back in the headlines since last week? Because it really has blown up again.
Yeah, so the potted history is that while we were recording last week's episode, there was a meeting of the Oireachtas Media Committee. Kevin Backhurst was in talking about some of the previous redundancy schemes and whatnot. People remember the controversy around the departure of one of the previous chief financial officers, Breda O'Keefe, and the fact that her redundancy was signed off on personally by Dee Forbes, but not supervised by anyone else. Kevin Backhurst revealed at that meeting that Breda O'Keefe had received a lump sum payment of €450,000 upon departing. That obviously pricked up a lot of political antennae because...
Stop on that point, okay. Because that was actually something which... The nature of how that actually was all handled in the moment and how that was actually revealed was quite dramatic.
Yeah, really remarkably so, because naturally enough, the report that had been commissioned by RTE and published by McCann Fitzgerald, the solicitors, had investigated who knew all about this. Was it part of the previous redundancy scheme? Who had oversight? Who was responsible? It effectively laid the whole thing at the feet of Dee Forbes. She had personally signed off on this, hadn't brought it to the attention of the senior leadership team as she was otherwise required to do. But nonetheless, that's how it happened. But we didn't know the exact financial spec of it. Alan Dillon, the Fine Gael TD for Mayo, is asking questions of Kevin Backhurst. He says, how much did she get? Kevin Backhurst says, I can't tell you that. It's confidential. There's certain rules around it. Mm-hmm. And then Alan says, but we're under privilege here. You're in the Oireachtas committee and transparency would be good for everyone. And Kevin Backhurst, 42 seconds after saying it's confidential that he couldn't tell it, says that it was €450,000.
There was such an about turn in it that it was quite... It was quite dramatic, really, because so Alan Dillon asked the question for a second time, and you start to hear the same sort of thing of like, look, there's confidentiality agreements relating to all of this. And then he just gets to a point where he just says, she got €450,000. Mm. And he was asked to repeat that. I just found that was quite dramatic. I think that probably did provoke something from members who were there.
There was purportedly a gasp in the room. Obviously, I wasn't there because we were here doing last week's episode. But a lot of members said that there
were... It was very Shakespearean that there was a gasp in the room.
There were literal gasps in the room. And you'd wonder, were the gasps because of the volume of the payment that she got? Mm. Or were the gasps because Kevin Backhurst went from, I can't tell you, to here I am telling you, in the space of literally 42 seconds. Mm. So either way, it naturally kickstarted the whole fresh batch of inquiry around, was that an appropriate amount to pay her? Was it all legally sound? Were there tax implications? Apparently that's now being investigated as well. But then it sort of kicked off this whole new thread pulling of what other payoffs have other departing senior members of RTE staff been given? And that's where things get a little bit more muddy for the present administration, because up until the last 7 days, everything we were talking about within RTE was stuff that Kevin Backhurst had inherited. They were stuff that was done before his watch.
Legacy matters.
Yeah. And that he was trying to clean up the situation left behind by others. Where we get into in the last couple of 7 days is stuff that's happened in the last 7 months, which is when Kevin Backhurst himself was in. So first of all, there's the one that we don't know very much about, which is the Breda O'Keefe's successor, Richard Collins. People might remember him last summer. He was the chief financial officer who couldn't remember what his salary was.
Well, see, this is how it's remembered now. But like, he initially said he didn't really know, but then he just basically said he kind of indicated he didn't know, but then he just refused to say it. And then he did say it. Mm. Approximately.
In a Backhurst-esque turn of events.
There's a strange parallel in that. Yeah. But that's what Richard Collins is effectively known in the public eye for, is that time where he didn't want to say his salary.
Yeah, which is a slightly unfair thing to remember him for, but nonetheless, it is the standout memory from all of those meetings. He departed in around October of last year. Yeah. His departure was the subject of some mediation. There was something of a payout, whether it's a severance, whether it's redundancy, we actually don't know how to characterise these things, which makes the reporting on it very woolly sometimes. But we don't know, was it severance, was it redundancy? We don't know what title to give it. Either way, he departed. He was given a payment of some sort. But because there was mediation involved, there is a non-disclosure aspect to it. So we don't know what that was. The other is Rory Coveney, the departed director of strategy. He was the master finder, the driving force behind the ill-fated Toy Show musical. I think we're actually...
Ill-fated?
We're
disastrous?
We're required to call it ill-fated, I think, before we say the name anymore.
It's a very flourishy word for what it was, which was an unmitigated disaster.
I feel like we're being diplomatic by calling it ill-fated.
I know, yeah. But so the man with sort of key responsibility for the €2.3 million fiasco that was Toy Show the musical is Rory Coveney. And he... left under the watch of Kevin Backhurst. So that's where it gets interesting.
Well, there's actually a question to that, because Kevin Backhurst, you might remember, was effectively acting as an almost semi-interim DG for a couple of weeks before he got the job. People might remember Dee Forbes left early. She was recommended for removal by the board, so she departed early. There was this void. Kevin Backhurst was going to be coming in anyway. So in a sort of an interim de facto way, he was sort of doing the job or preparing the stuff for his first day. People might remember that the weekend before Kevin Backhurst was due to officially start, there was a statement issued by Rory Coveney saying that he understood the need for there to be a fresh new broom, that RTE couldn't have these lingering clouds still over it because of his association with the previous system and because it would be better for everyone to have a fresh start, that he was resigning with immediate effect. Now, bear in mind, immediate effect. So he was gone the weekend before Kevin Backhurst formally came in. And the public presentation was that he had resigned. Now, on the Monday, Kevin Backhurst formally gets his feet under the door. He announces this new senior management team. There was a press conference at Montrose. Both you and Zara were both there.
It felt like it was about a 30-minute press conference, in very much in keeping with the messaging of this is a new and open administration and I'm here to answer every single question. But the fact is that one of the questions which was asked by Fionnán Sheehan of The Independent related to Rory Coveney. And though the question that Kevin Backhurst gave there, I think, has probably become more pertinent now because he has now gone on and characterised it as saying, well, I did indicate that there was some form of payment or exit package to Rory Coveney on the way out the door. Whereas if you look back at what was actually said at the time, probably doesn't mirror it exactly, to be kind anyway.
But also, if it is it's now been characterised because Kevin Backhurst has been dealing with some questions about this again this week, and he said on Radio 1 on Monday that he basically agreed to roll Rory Coveney's duties into those of Adrian Lynch, who was the acting DG during the previous time after Dee Forbes had gone. So basically, the role of director of strategy was being made redundant. So because the job was being abolished, Rory Coveney was basically given a severance or a redundancy on his way out, roughly equivalent to 12 months of his salary. Now, you could make that explanation at the time and it would carry a lot of water. You could say it's a big sum of money, but you have to break eggs to make an omelette. And if you want to try and have a fresh start and you want to get rid of some of the personnel, this is the consequence of doing that. Had they said that up front, I suspect it would have been a lot more tolerable for a lot of people. But instead, you're told he is resigning so as to clear the way for a new regime. Then you're told afterwards, well, he's resigning upon negotiation, where he's been given 12 months salary to go away, which is simply just not the presentation that we're all given last summer. And this is where, as you say, things get interesting, because this is the watch of Kevin Backhurst. And up until now, it's been legacy stuff.
So that's the key political pressure which has been put on Kevin Backhurst, because I think until this point, people who are politicians, and that's actually across parties as well, whether it's in the government parties or it's in Sinn Féin or independents or other opposition groupings, they've generally all, whenever I speak to them about anything to do with this, they're all generally quite happy with some of the reforms put in place by Kevin Backhurst. They're all like, let's wait and see. He talks the talk. He seems to be walking the walk up until this point, but that seems to be where there's now a bit of any of that confidence has been built there, particularly in government circles, does seem to be faltering, because these are big amounts of money in terms of exit payments, which are only sort of properly coming to light now in terms of how we see them as the general public. And if some of them happened on his watch, or he had signed, or he allowed there to be confidentiality agreements, the question which people in government are particularly asking is, why did he feel the need to do that?
So we don't know, again, what the exact circumstances were of Richard Collins going on. He was still there for a couple of months after Kevin Backhurst formally took the reins. He wasn't in this newly remodeled senior leadership team. But one of the vagaries is that we don't know whether his role was made redundant. There isn't a new CFO, as far as I know, but that's because of a recruitment embargo. We actually don't know whether the position was abolished. So if it were abolished, he's entitled to a redundancy. But if this was some sort of negotiated, mediated departure, then we simply don't know the circumstances. So we don't know why there might have been an NDA involved. Perhaps there's some other completely extraneous circumstances. And on Rory Coveney, there wasn't any NDA involved in that one. So at least Kevin Backhurst was able to say last weekend what was going on. But the way in which this matters politically is that from the government's perspective, yes, RTE has been a bit of a disaster for the last 8 months, but the government knows that, A, it cannot afford to let RTE die. It can't allow it to wither on the vine. So it needs to have a public broadcaster which is resourced to do all the stuff that private sector comparators like us just can't do. But that they can't go ahead writing blank checks until they know that there's been some sort of cultural change or some new leaf being turned over in RTE. And it's really demoralising for a lot of ministers to find out that now, when Kevin Backhurst was coming in last summer and he came in with all this wave of goodwill and with good blessings and people saying, you know, you have a big job ahead of you, but we all wish you well, to discover that while he was apparently being so transparent as to give half-hour press conferences with all of the country's media gathered outside.
Many lengthy interviews as well at the time.
Like, completely. Yeah. Like, he was a very open book at the time. But at the same time, he was negotiating deals which, A, resulted in the expenditure of money that may not have had to be spent, and B, that he was doing it with a level of secrecy that even he now seems to recognise as being somehow regrettable. You know, Kevin Backhurst was in talking to Catherine Martin on Monday. He was asked to go away and get more legal advice to see, are there any details relating to Richard Collins in particular that can be published, that maybe he can get legal advice that certain amounts are free to disclose. I got a message from one cabinet minister who saw our reporting on that afterwards, and they said the idea that he is now looking for credit for trying to unseal a deal that he himself signed off on and sealed was nonsense. Was not the word in the text, but sometimes this goes out pre-watershed, so I can't use the exact word. It starts with a B. And that's kind of where we are, that where previously there was all this goodwill of Backhurst will do the rehabilitation and then we can figure out how we're going to pay for all of this. That rehabilitation dramatically flipped backwards this week, and there are some now who don't want to press the nuclear button. Like, they don't want to
talk, because the talk, the nuclear button is there's question marks, and some journalists have asked, you know, whether Kevin Backhurst should resign.
Yeah.
I don't think there's any, that's not an immediate option on the table.
But there's a genuine question around the obfuscation, around why there was an NDA and why there has been such a competing or slightly tortured explanation as to how some of these came about.
So this is going to be I think it's fair to characterize this now as almost a kind of a poisonous situation in terms of how festering it has become now for the government, because they've now sort of seemed to get a bit of a hang of it in terms of where RTE was going. Kevin had his feet under the desk and things were moving in the right direction. So if the politicians are feeling the heat over it and they're starting to get a little bit aggrieved on it, it's interesting as well that people I know within RTE who've been at the last number of town hall meetings, as they're known as in RTE, that they think that they've noticed a change in Kevin as well.
How so?
In terms of they feel that he's become a little bit more downbeat, that they've noticed a change in his attitude. Now, we've asked him to appear on the podcast today. He's not available today. Says that's probably something that's going to happen in the future. So you can hold out for the Director General of RTE future being on the podcast.
Sammy Alaga will give him such a grill.
But the thing is that there is, and this is, you can only go by a couple of people's different feelings on this, is that they feel that he's a bit more downbeat, that they aren't seeing the same zeal that they saw at the start of things. And maybe their assessment is that he's understood how difficult a job actual cultural change is in an organisation of the likes of RTE.
And that might well be the case, that it's only a fixed term tenure anyway. I think it's a fixed appointment of, is it 6 or 7 years? And that when he took the job, not knowing that any of this was coming down the line, he'd already been appointed as the acting or the forthcoming DG before the controversy around the payments to Ryan Tubridy and then everything else that followed. So this is not the job that he necessarily signed up for. You can understand when he gets the job, okay, you come with a certain amount of zeal, as you say, and you come at it with all this bucket loads of energy, and you hope that with a few months heavy lifting, you might be back at what should be square one. You can move on from there. You can understand if he's a little demoralised or depleted by how long it's taken to really rectify the ship. But unfortunately, it is the consequences of his own actions in the first couple of weeks which are now causing it to be so difficult.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Speaking of stories that have never, ever gone away, Gavin, where I'm going?
No, I don't know which one you're talking about.
The Metrolink.
Oh, that one. Okay. Because there's two stories in this part, both of which seem to have been going on for an interminable amount of time. Let's start with the Metro.
The artist formerly known as Metro North is back in the headlines. And we have a projected date for when trains will be rolling down that track.
What is that date?
It'll be 2034, 2035.
Okay.
So
it's not so much a date as a window, really. It's like a National Children's Hospital level of vagueness.
But there is a feeling now that this is, well, I'm actually going to double back on that immediately. There was a feeling, as you speak to some people, that this is now the home stretch for Metrolink to finally get it home, because it's now entered the On Board Planala oral hearings on planning.
So you were there on Monday. These are long-running hearings which are going to be going on for a couple of weeks.
Six weeks.
You were there for day one,
yes.
At least. What did you hear?
Ah, I heard some great things. The Metrolink is going to save the city. And it could well do if you actually. I mean, let's run through some of the facts about it. Metrolink is something which has been talked about since 1985 when Charlie Haughey mentioned it in the Dáil.
And only 39 years later, we finally got into oral planning.
We had previously been at this point, which is actually another point worth mentioning. 15 years ago, we got to the oral planning hearing stages for the Metro. The plug was pulled very soon after that because of.
Well, yes.
Obvious reasons.
Events occurred.
Financial crisis. The plug was pulled. 2015, it was revived. 2018, the plan was to bring it all the way to Sandyford. That was revised back because it would cause too much disruption in terms of the Green Lewis line.
Yeah. So maybe just as an interruption there, just to explain to people, particularly non-Dubliners. So
they all know about it.
Yeah, but the Green Lewis line, which in its initial incarnation ran from Stephen's Green out to Sandyford, it was built with the prospect of being future upgraded to a metro, which means heavier trains running at higher frequency. One of the concerns that's arisen in the course of that is that one of the communities that the Lewis line runs through, it's quite important, they say, for you to be able to cross the Lewis line and get from one side to the other. There's a particular shop that's at one Lewis platform and people from around there are able to cross the track. If you upgrade it to a metro, the trains run so frequently that basically they say it's like having an artery through the city. Now, everyone concedes that's a great inconvenience for them. Their local politicians are certainly gone out of their way to stress how much of an inconvenience that is for them. Whether the entirety of Dublin North and South should have a massive rail project delayed because of the inconvenience to one stretch of road is an open debate.
Yeah, and one which is going to be, this is the whole purpose of these hearings, is for On Board Planola to make a decision on it.
But that's why the plan for now is for the Metro to stop at Stephen's Green rather than going the whole way to the south.
Well, it's the end point for Metrolink as it currently stands, the end terminus after it's started all the way north of Swords and come past through Dublin Airport, through Glasnevin, through O'Connell Street, to St. Stephen's Green, and then it ends in Charlemont, which is basically just north of Ranelagh, where the Green Line Lewis stop currently is. That has provoked something of a backlash from local politicians, including Michael McDougall, Jim O'Callaghan. A lot of people have aimed a lot of flack at these people for raising this concern because they say we've had so many holdups here. The traffic problem in Dublin is so chronic at this point. TII, Transport Infrastructure Ireland, which is pushing, of course, the project. It says Dublin is now the 35th most congested city in the world, which may not sound that high, but if you count every single city in the world with massive transport problems, that's very high indeed.
It's not the 35th highest capital. It's the 35th highest city.
Yeah. Think about all the cities in America and India and Brazil and China, which must be thronged with traffic. And little old Dublin is right up there at 35th. There's also the fact that they had stats that 213 hours from every commuter is wasted every year behind the wheel in traffic, that this all adds up over time to just being a €2 billion drain on the Irish economy every year.
213 hours?
I'd well believe it. Sometimes driving
every year.
Driving to get here to the podcast studio is often the traffic heaviest time of the week.
It often happens. We were only discussing earlier on that sometimes I'm often in Leinster House for the 12:30 news and I get to leave at about 20 to 1, 12:45 to come back out here to do 2 o'clock. One time a couple of weeks ago, I literally was walking into the room at a minute to two, didn't get to stop for lunch anyway. It literally just took that long with the traffic. Today I was back in the building at about 1:15. It took half an hour to make the journey. But other days it could take 75 minutes. And that's at lunchtime. That's before you're factoring in a rainy day or one collision on the M50 or someone has a breakdown on an off ramp and the whole thing backs up. And then you throw an extra 10 years of population onto that and economic growth before you might have the metro up and running.
That's the key here.
Yeah.
Is that we already have a huge spike in population growth even since, you know, the latest iteration of the Metrolink was unveiled. By the time it's actually built, best estimates or best possible case, best scenario being 2034, 2035, it's going to be even very different city once again. I'm running through some of the potential hitches here because some people probably don't understand what actually is going to be disrupted once this thing is up and running in terms of demolition jobs. OPW, the Office of Public Works, which is one of the bodies which is going to be presenting at these oral hearings over the next number of weeks, it has grave concerns about the future of Stephen's Green, the park itself, because effectively the stop for Metrolink will be in the Green. So it's going to require a great bit of digging up. TII says it'll actually preserve, you know, to the best of its ability, the character and, you know, the nature of St. Stephen's Green Park. But OPW, which is responsible for running the park, says there's going to be severe disruption there and it will be like a very impactful change there. There's a there's an office block, or actually an apartment block, I should say, with about 70 something apartments, which is going to have to be bulldozed for that. That has the Markovic gym.
The Markovic Leisure Centre and the swimming pool and all of that. And it's the one just behind Tower Street.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's a relatively modern development. That's only like a late 2000s development, I think. So the idea that you'd have to flatten that after barely 20 years of existence.
Exactly. That's going to have to make way to go. The Carlton Cinema on O'Connell Street, which is basically, I'm not actually sure what's actually in there in the moment, but they're going to protect the facade of it and bulldoze the rest of it. I like, some people have been complaining about that for there to be another demolition of a building on O'Connell Street is awful, but you could also make the counterpoint, what's another demolition on a street, which is half demolished down that end anyway.
Yes, yeah.
And then there's the other one, which is the Hedigan's Pub, which was in Ulysses by James Joyce. It's in Glasnevin, the Brian Boru Pub. So that's going to be effectively bulldozed as well. So all of these different parties to this, and all different politicians and other members of the public who want to raise their hands, they're going to get to do so over the next 6 weeks. So the point to finish off on the Metrolink is that even if they get through all this, and there's dozens to over 100, I think it's 130 something people have indicated that they want to speak at these. Even if you get this clear and it gets the thumbs up, it's not over yet. Because then the TII has to bring that planning permission and make a business case to government to get the final say and the final go ahead.
And then you start putting shovels in the soil, and it still takes 6 or 7 or 8 years after that to actually deliver.
I don't think I'll ever get to commute on Metrolink until I retire, but we'll wait and see. But other infrastructure actually was in the headlines as well this
week. Actually, well, let me put a question to you. As a firm League of Ireland man, in fact, as a co-owner of a League of Ireland club, actually, a League of Ireland club, which is about to get a new premises.
Part owner, not co-owner. Co-owner makes it look like I'm a one of two shareholders at a club.
You're like a David Gold figure. Daily Mount Park is now finally getting the go-ahead for a massive redevelopment, but it's been a very long and tortuous road to get there, and getting City Council approval and finding out whether other clubs are going to be stakeholders in that has been a really torturous thing. And there's other League of Ireland clubs like Finn Harps in the middle are trying to do a ground redevelopment at the moment. They're not sure how it's going to go, and that might raise questions about the viability of the club. Given all of that, how do you feel about the government almost overnight, willy-nilly, with apparently no conditions attached, writing a cheque for a GAA ground in another jurisdiction for 50 million quid?
I'm going to surprise you and say absolutely fine. Absolutely fine. The money for Casement Park, the 50 million euros that is being given by the Republic of Ireland government towards Casement Park, which, as you rightly say, is in Belfast, that's not coming from football money. Like, it's not from the same pot.
Yeah.
Like, it's not as if this is taking more money from other sporting projects in this country.
So it's not,
this is part of shared Ireland. Yeah. This is a long-term fund, which the government here has been putting money away into. And the bigger project is obviously the A5, but Casement Park is something which is interesting. But also, I've seen people like Damien Duff, for example, raise questions as to whether or not this is good use of money.
Well, there's a kind of an inequality of treatment. They said even if they're coming out of different pots and this doesn't deduct from the money that's available for League of Ireland grounds, the ease with which the GAA was able to get money out of the government when it takes so long for soccer clubs to get it from the same source.
I can see it, I can see the point, but as I say, I think it's just a different pot of money. It's an infrastructure project for a better island of Ireland. There's the Euro 2028 question. Money is needed for that because Stormont is still about whether or not they're going to give money to Casement Park. As well as that, it is also probably going to be the stadium headquarters of Ulster GAA, of which a significant part of Ulster GAA represents counties in the Republic.
About a sixth of the population lives in the Republic, so there's an argument for that, sir.
There we go. People do have views on that, so actually it would be interesting to hear where our listenership does stand in terms of the volume of money going towards Casement Park in this regard. Well, replacing our weekly big cars segment for this week, Gavin, is a more intermittent look at how AI is going to kill us, take all our jobs and ruin the world as we know it.
Yeah, well, specifically our jobs, at least anyway. Yeah. We should say, by the way, as a precursor, this may not be very stimulating material to those who are listening to the audio version of this podcast.
Because I would say.
Because what we're talking about is a new video AI tool. So the makers of ChatGPT, a company called OpenAI, have now unveiled, they haven't yet made it public for reasons we want to talk about in a minute, but they have developed software which can create videos out of only text prompts.
So this is the thing. People might have seen these before. They probably will have seen these before, where you go onto a site like Midjourney or what's the other one called? There's one called Crayon as well, isn't there?
Yeah, there's a few different options around there.
And you just type in a prompt like Joe Biden in GTA Vice City. This actually works very well, actually.
Yeah, because he wears those aviators all the time anyway, so it's a very easy recreation.
Exactly. And
you can say, show me Bruno Fernandes winning the Champions League, and it will create you an image, which is never going to happen in real life. But OpenAI are now debuting this new software, which is going to be able to create them in a much greater level of sophistication than we've seen before. We actually have some video that we can show you. This is what happens when you insert into AI's OpenAI's new software A stylish woman walks down a Tokyo street filmed with warm glowing neon and animated city signage. She wears a black leather jacket, a long red dress and black boots and carries a black purse. She wears sunglasses and lipstick. She walks confidently, casually. The street is damp and reflective. So what you're seeing on screen does not exist. This footage is entirely created with no source guidance. There's no, here is a cityscape for you to use. What you're seeing is created by a machine solely based on words that were put into it.
Very worrying that. That is worrying because that is very photorealistic, even down to like sort of acne scars on the woman's face.
Yeah.
One point which actually is worth, because it just occurred to me there, that one of the tips which people have for if you want to spot what's an AI deepfake in terms of video or photo generated online, like stuff like that Pope in the big coat thing.
Yes, yeah.
Text. Text on clothing in particular. So if somebody is purported to be a police officer,
yeah,
text is not going to say police.
Yeah, it's usually kind of nonsensical. It's just some random selection of letters because it doesn't. It's language agnostic, so it doesn't know what to put in there. Also, sometimes the recreation of fingers is a bit wonky. So you might see a person who's ostensibly posing, but if you look, they don't have any knuckles, or they might have five fingers on one hand, because one thing AI is notoriously bad at is recreating fingers. But we're now seeing that this has been produced at a level of sophistication that we have never seen before. AI, OpenAI, the company behind it, say they're not going to roll it out to the mass market as yet, because they're actually pointedly trying to make sure that it isn't open to bad faith manipulation.
I trust them.
Well, a genuine question that comes up is whether you trust the makers of this software to be the gatekeepers, or whether somebody else should be standing in the way, some sort of.
And that never really happens. You never really have the makers of a technology of this, you know, just paradigm changing nature.
Yeah.
End up just basically putting up the guardrails for it and safely guiding everyone through its existence.
Yeah, and of course, but on the flip side, if you try to make a government or someone else like that responsible for it, how do you make sure that they can do something? They introduce rules now for software that will exist in 6 months' time. It's a very kind of tricky thing to do. Well, I think we just should say, by the way, as a precursor, not to just make this a full ad for OpenAI. They have been accused, accused of slightly overstating this, because they've got a content arrangement with Shutterstock,
because
they make stock video. And if you look at some of the videos that they've published, which showcase how good this is, some of the videos are actually quite similar to videos that are already out there. So this is a video of a Victoria pigeon showing off its plumage. This is the one that's been generated by the OpenAI software, but we can show you another video, which is something that they've got access to. The other video that we can see is a video that's produced by Shutterstock of the same bird. So actually, are they creating a new video, or are they just repackaging the one that's there? Yeah. So some little caveats about it.
I don't think it matters at all, but I think it's worrying that in all of the time that we've been trying to build Metrolink, this technology has advanced to such a degree.
Yeah.
And all these questions about, AI generation things is like six fingers and there's like adds the legs to cats and stuff like that. And this isn't going to matter in a year's time.
You know, how much would it cost us to generate an AI version of the National Children's Hospital?
Yeah, it'll be quicker. Anyway, that's all the time we have for On The Group Chat this week. Gavin, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Richard.
And we'll see you next week.
Bye, everyone. We'll be right back.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.